funny things. It can be hard to tell good stories. It's fun to tell funny stories. And it's actually tough to tell stories when you're preaching. Well, actually, I take that back. Lots of pastors tell stories. I would say it is tough to tell stories well while preaching, because it's hard to find the right story for the text. It's hard to find the story that applies to all people. I've heard lots of stories and sermons that I thought, that's a cute story. I'm not sure what that has to do with the rest of the sermon. So it's hard to tell stories in sermons. And the most critical people of other people's preaching are pastors, because we all know how to do it better, right? So anyway. But culturally, not just culturally, but as human beings, all cultures tell stories. Why? Why do we tell stories? Why are stories so valuable to us? You know, why do we, like, what is their purpose? Why do we tell fictional stories? You know, we are in love with stories. Look at our consumption of television. Those are stories. Even the news, which isn't supposed to be a fictional story, they still encapsulate their presentation and call it a news story. What is it about the power of story? And I think it's because stories are an attempt, or they are a tool we use to help us make sense of the world around us. Stories are a way to try and take information and weave it together to make some coherence out of it. They offer explanations for the things we see, or they may be ways for us to explore what is true and what is beautiful and what is meaningful. Stories are ways to organize truth and beauty to make sense of them and to remember them. It is in telling our stories that we wrap our minds around truth and convey truth and pass that truth along to others and to following generations. I actually remember stories fairly well, and often I remember stories better than I remember a doctrine or a formula or a creed. There's an ancient Chinese story about a man who had two loves in his life, his son and horses. And this is the way I heard the story told, but it's been mildly adapted. One day the man's horse escaped the barn and disappeared. And the people from the village, they came and they said, "Oh, how unlucky you are. How God has cursed you that you have lost your one horse." And the man says, "I don't know if God has cursed me. I don't know if I'm lucky or unlucky." And he went in that night and he knelt by his bed and he prayed and he thanked God for his blessings. But a few days later, the horse returned, and the horse came back leading a herd of wild horses, and suddenly they had a ton of horses, and the people of the village said, "Oh, wow, truly you are lucky, truly you are blessed that now you have so many horses. Your horse not only returned, but brought more horses with you." And the man said, "I don't know. I don't know if I'm lucky. I don't know if I am blessed." And he went in that night, and he knelt by his bed, and he prayed, and he thanked God again for his blessings. But then the man's beloved son was working with these horses. He was trying to break the horses so they were rideable, and one of the horses threw him and trampled him and broke his leg. And so his son now was lame and would never walk without a limp again. And the villagers came and said, "Oh, you are not lucky. You are not blessed. You are cursed by God that now your son is lame." And the man shook his head and he said, "I don't know if I am blessed or if I am cursed." He went in that night and he knelt by his bed and he prayed and he thanked God for his blessings and he prayed for his son. Time went by and war came to the land. And the soldiers came and they took all of the man's horses to take them through the battle. And they just confiscated them. And the villagers said, "Oh, now we know you are cursed, because not only is your son lame, but now all of your horses are gone." The man shook his head and he said, "I don't know if I am cursed or if I am blessed." And he went in and he knelt by the side of the bed and he cried and he prayed and he thanked God for his blessings and asked for him to provide. And the war went poorly. The war turned against their land and the soldiers came back, and this time they didn't take the horses from the village. They took all the young and able-bodied men from the village to go off and fight the war. But they left the man's son, because his son was lame. And the villagers came to him and said, "Truly, you are blessed by God, because you still have your son." I first heard that story over 25 years ago. I was at a youth service back when I lived in Nova Scotia, and it was actually a man who's now a good friend of mine. He's a pastor in Ottawa now, but he was going to seminary in Nova Scotia. It was one of my dad's students, and he was speaking at a youth service. And I remember him telling that story. And I don't know what it is about that story that has stuck with me all of these years. And I've looked for it, and I've investigated it, and learned more about it, and learned that he Christianized it. He added the prayer part. It's an ancient Chinese story just about fortune, you know, luck and unluck, and that we won't know until the end of the day. But the power of the story is still there. Stories are powerful. Growing up, my dad would sometimes tell stories that some of you may not realize. My dad is actually a retired pastor, and he actually a retired professor of theology, and studied a lot of church history. And my dad would sometimes get passionate and get emotional talking, sharing stories about revivals that have happened at different points in history. And one of the stories he told that always fascinated me, I heard a lot of these stories, and I would often ask, again, for clarification on the names, because the people involved were just names to me, and I'm horrible with names. But this one story is the story of Duncan Campbell. Duncan Campbell was a Highlander from Scotland, and he was born in 1898, so turn of the century, last century. And he became a Christian when he was about 15 years old, and shortly thereafter, World War I broke out, and he served in the British Army. He served in British cavalry. And he was involved in the last charge of British cavalry in World War I in 1918. It was the last battle in which the British cavalry served, and he was wounded. You know, you have cavalry charging machine guns, which is a recipe for disaster. And he was wounded, he was knocked from his horse, he was lying in the mud, and he believed he was dying. And not only had he been wounded, but then a Canadian cavalry regiment charged over the same tract of land, and he was trampled by the Canadian cavalry. And one of the Canadian horses stepped right in the middle of his back, and he said later, there's still a mark there. But when that horse stepped on him, he groaned. And the Canadian soldier heard the groan. And so after the cavalry charge was done, and they turned around and they went back, that Canadian soldier went back to find the man he had heard who was alive. And he found Duncan Campbell lying in the mud. His back was broken. He was wounded. He picked him up, and he strapped him to his horse and then slapped the horse hard so the horse would run back to the aid station. So bouncing up and down, wounded on the back of that horse, Duncan Campbell was sure he was going to die, but he was lamenting the fact that he had never led anybody to Jesus. He had never had the chance to share the gospel. Well, he had a chance. He had never taken the opportunity to share the gospel with anybody. And he thought, here I am. I'm about to appear before my Lord and Savior, and I have nothing to show for it. And as he prayed on the back of that horse, he prayed, Father in heaven, I'm dying. Please make me as holy as a saved sinner can be. And he was echoing the prayer of a famous Scottish evangelist from a previous generation, Robert Murray McShane. And he prayed that prayer, and on the battlefield, in the mud, amidst the storm of, you know, thunder, of artillery, and heading back to that aid station, the Holy Spirit descended on Duncan Campbell in a tangible way. And when he arrived at that Canadian aid station, Duncan Campbell spoke no English. He only spoke Gaelic. And the Canadian aid workers only spoke English. And yet when he arrived, he started singing a psalm in Gaelic. And the Spirit of the Lord fell on that aid station, and the Canadian aid workers started coming to Christ, listening to this person singing in Gaelic. And they knew it was the Holy Spirit because they came to Campbell, and he remembers them saying to us, Trooper, can you not tell us about Jesus? We want to know about Jesus. And seven of those aid workers across the language barrier, not able to understand a word he said, came to Christ in that moment. That story has stuck with me from the dinner table as a teenager, hearing that story. Father, I'm dying. Make me as holy as a saved sinner can be. And that's a prayer that God answered in power. Stories are powerful things. Later, Duncan Campbell survived his wounds. They treated him. He was able to recover. He actually became a minister. And while speaking at a conference in London, England, the Spirit whispered to him, "You need to go back to Scotland." And he said, he was embarrassed. He got up and he started to speak to the people. And he said, "I'm sorry, I have to go." And he left and he went on a train and he went up to the Hebrides, the islands in the north of Scotland. And when he arrived, there's a group of people there who had been praying for months that God would send revival. And Duncan Campbell arrived, and he got off the train, and he went to the little church where they had been praying, and the Holy Spirit fell. And the whole town came back to Christ because he obeyed. And the Spirit worked in him again, tangibly, in the 1900s. These are stories that stick with us. During his earthly ministry, Jesus taught using stories because they are powerful. We call them parables because they're a specific type of story. They're parallels taken from everyday life used to illustrate a point. But we're actually told that with the crowds, Jesus only taught them in stories. He only taught them in parables and stories. And in private, he would explain the stories to his disciples. But even though he wasn't explaining the stories, explaining the parables to the crowds were amazed at his teaching and said, "He teaches with authority, not like our scribes and other teachers." Stories force people to think. They enable people to remember. They put people in the same story and ask them how they would respond. Stories are powerful. Stories help people connect with the truth. And I think that's why Jesus taught in parables. He taught people and help them connect with the truth, because he took stories from everyday life, like sowing seed in the farmer's field, or looking for a lost sheep, or sweeping up the house looking for a lost coin. He connected people with the truth because of stories taken from everyday life. There's a powerful example of a story in the Old Testament, a parable like Jesus taught, found in 2 Samuel. This is the point where David, now king, the slayer of Goliath, is now king, and he's committed adultery with a woman named Bathsheba. And having committed adultery, she got pregnant, and David has tried repeatedly to cover it up, and her husband is not cooperating with the cover-up, and so David actually arranges, because the husband is a soldier, he arranges to have him sent to the front of the battle, where he gets killed in action. And so this is what's happened, and now that Bathsheba's a widow, David's able to take her as his own. And so he's taken her to the palace to be another one of his wives. So turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 12. We're going to see the power of the story in 2 Samuel chapter 12. If you'd like to move along, you raise your hand. If you don't have a Bible, we'll get one to you. In the church Bibles, this is found on page 222. 222, 2 Samuel chapter 12. I'm going to read verses 1 to 10. It's not quite the entire story, but it covers the... It's not the entire story, it covers the story. It's not the entire narrative description. 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 1 to 10. "Now the Lord sent Nathan, a prophet, to David, the king. When Nathan came to him, he said, 'There are two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, it drank from his cup, it even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lambs that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come to him." David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite," that's Bathsheba's husband, You struck him down with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites, the people they were in battle with. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own." The power of a story is the power used to confront a king. Imagine being Nathan. He's a known prophet. He's met David before. David recognizes him as a prophet. But imagine being given the job of confronting the king and condemning him. But not just any king, but the king who is a warrior king. How did David become king? How did he become famous? By taking out the giant Goliath, and by then leading the Israelites into battle time and time again. He's killed his tens of thousands of Philistines. He is a warrior. He is a fighter. And here is Nathan asked to go, "Hey, yeah, you've got to go confront the king who's, committing adultery," which probably wasn't that common knowledge. And so how does Nathan go about doing that? How do you confront a king? How do you confront somebody who is probably going to be defensive, who's already hiding something, and who has the power to have you executed? How do you do that? You do that through the power of a story. Because the story put David in the situation and asked David how he would respond. And then it was revealed that David was already in the story. You know, David was a shepherd. He understood sheep. He understood the difference between having a flock and having a pet. How do you approach a king? Nathan used the power of story to convict King David of his sin. Stories can be convicted. Describes the two men under different circumstances with different hearts. The one, a poor man, has only the ewe who is his pet. The second, a wealthy man, has herds and cattle and sheep and lots. But he steals the beloved pet from his neighbor out of selfishness and cruelty, coldness of heart. David's passionate response to Nathan's story reveals the truth his conscience was aware of, but that his mind was pushed down. His passionate outburst. This is the type of story that would come to a king, right? David's son, Solomon, he has a story brought to him about, how do you adjudicate when two women have babies and one of the babies has died? How do you adjudicate? This is the type of thing kings were expected to do. And so Nathan brings him a story. "Hey, you know what? In one of the villages in your kingdom, this is what's happened. What do we do?" David's passionate response shows him that he knows what is right. He knows what is right, but he's living against it. His mind has pushed it down. He's hardened his heart. He's muted his conscience. So sometimes a story can reveal truth to us that we know, but we don't want to admit. Because that's the power of story. Jesus told parables to force people to reconsider what they thought they knew. Jesus had to change what people thought about their status with God, about what it means to be holy, about what it means to be God's people, about what God's authority is like, about what the Messiah would be like. He had to challenge all of their ideas, and he did so in story. Because if he just came out and said, "Oh yeah, you're wrong about this, this, and this," they'd just say, "Who are you to tell us?" So instead he told stories to draw out of them the truth, or to draw them into the story so that the truth could be revealed to them. This is the power of story. That stories can challenge our assumptions, they can challenge our conclusions, and even our worldviews. What does it mean? I want to ask you, of the three stories that we've considered today, the story of the man with the sun and the horse, the story of Duncan Campbell being wounded in World War I and the spirit falling on him, and then the story of the two men, one with many herds of sheep and cattle and one with a pet, land. Of these three stories, which of them are true? Which of these stories are true? It's kind of a trick question, actually, because it calls into the question, what does it mean for a story to be true? The first story, the one about the man, the ancient story from China about the man with the horse and his son, may not be historical. There may never have been a man who actually had that happen. It's a reasonable story for it to have happened, we don't know. But it certainly illustrates a powerful truth that in the midst of this life, we don't know if we are blessed or cursed. We don't know how things are going to turn out. We don't know what will come from tragedy. So it illustrates a truth. It may not be anchored in history, but it illustrates an important truth. The second story about Duncan Campbell in World War I is a very true story. It's true in pretty much any aspect you could ask of it. But it's interesting because it also points to a spiritual truth beyond physical reality, beyond kind of material reality that we usually deal with. The third story, the story of the two men, one with the herds of sheep and one with the pet lamb, is that a true story? Well, it's a parable, but it's true in a different way. Because certainly when Nathan revealed to David, it was a true story. The names have been changed to protect the guilty until it needs to be revealed. Stories can be true in different ways because it depends on why the story is being told. If you ask Nathan the prophet, is your story about the sheep true? He would say, oh yes, it is a true story. It's just not about sheep, it's about women, about wives. So where am I going with all this? Stories are powerful, stories are meaningful, but stories are something we often take for granted. Sometimes when we use the word story, we immediately dismiss it, that, oh, that's not true, I don't need to wrestle with it. I don't need to deal with the truth of it, because it's a story, or it's just a story. We don't think about stories and their power and their significance. We don't think about the stories that we digest on a regular basis. We don't think about the stories we watch on TV, because they're just stories. But the stories are powerful, whether we admit it or not. We never talk about the significance of the fact that we tell stories. You know, dogs don't tell stories to each other. Monkeys don't tell stories to each other. Birds don't tell stories to each other. Why do we tell stories? Why do we create fictional stories? The fact that we compose fiction that doesn't correspond to the material world that we're familiar with, the fact that we have imagination and creativity, is actually significant. It's something that I think materialists take for granted. Why are we storytellers? Well, I would say we are storytellers because God is a storyteller. And we are made after the likeness of God. And God is a storyteller. The Bible is the true story of God's loving pursuit of fallen people for the sake of reconciling them to himself. Not pursuit to punish, not pursuit to harm, but pursuit to reconcile to himself. This is the story of the Bible. It contains many smaller stories, for sure. We just read one of them. The Bible contains many different kinds of stories. There are parables, like the parables Jesus told or that Nathan told. There are other stories that are historical stories about people. There are poems and songs and proverbs, and there's a whole range of something called apocalyptic, which is a whole other ball of wax. But all of these are individual stories that, when put together in the way that they've been composed, form the true story of God's loving pursuit of fallen people, us, for the sake of reconciling us to himself. But regardless of the kinds of stories within the Bible as a whole is a much larger story. And this is actually a powerful lens we need to use when we read the Bible. When we come to parts describing evil and sin, people are often turned off, like, oh, you know, why is that in the Bible? Because it's the story of the pursuit of fallen people. And when you're pursuing fallen people, the fallenness of those people will come through loud and clear. When we come to parts of redemption or justice or forgiveness, this is the part of the story of God's pursuit to reconcile us to himself. These are demonstrations of, these are tastes of, these are previews of God's mercy and his justice and how they're held in tension. And we, as we read these passages, as we read through the Bible, we need to remember that this is a big story. Maybe the individual little stories don't apply to me, but the big story that they compose is the big story of God's loving pursuit of me, a fallen person. so that God can reconcile me to himself. There's a fancy word for big stories. It's meta-narratives. If you've studied any literature, or if you've heard of postmodernism or any of that, we can even talk about it a little bit here. Meta just means overarching, and narrative just means story. Big story. There's another kind of big story that people tell, and we label them as myths. Now, the problem with the word myth is that today, different from 100 years ago, the word myth just means, oh, that's just make-believe. That's not true. But actually, myths are a kind of story that actually illustrate a kind of truth. There is a truth to them that may not be a truth like the material world, like describing Duncan Campbell and being wounded and sent back to the aid station, but there is a kind of truth to them, perhaps like the story from China, or perhaps like the parable that Nathan told. But they are true in their own sort of way. Of all of the big stories that help people understand reality, though, the Bible is the one anchored in history. The Bible is the big story anchored in history. Many of you have heard C.S. Lewis, a famous Christian author in the 20th century. He wrote the Narnia books, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. They made a bunch of movies about him. Many of you have heard of J.R.R. Tolkien and The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, also big movies, famous books, you know, bazillions of copies sold. Did you know that it was Tolkien who was actually influential in bringing C.S. Lewis to Christianity? They were good friends. They were actually best friends. They both worked and taught at Oxford University in the 1920s and 30s. And they were in different English departments and the different colleges. And it was interesting, actually, because C.S. Lewis was a literary person, and Tolkien was a language person, a linguistics person. And those sides of the department were actually at odds with one another because of funding and competition about what we should do with language and that sort of thing. And Tolkien and Lewis actually crossed that gap, and they became solid friends. And Lewis had been raised in a Christian home, but then became an atheist as a teenager, and he had rejected Christianity. And in 1931, Lewis and Tolkien, they were out for a walk together, actually with another friend of theirs, another Christian named Hugo Dyson. And they had, Lewis later writes about the fact that they had this conversation that went on for like 8 hours. They were out for a walk, they came home, they were in one of their rooms, they were talking for hours and hours and hours on end, hammering back and forth questions of literature, questions of myth, questions of Christianity, questions of truth. And later, Lewis wrote that this was pivotal in his coming to Christ. He said, by the end of that conversation, Tolkien and Dyson had convinced Lewis that Christianity was the one true myth, or the one big story, from which all of the other stories find their source. We have a little video, C.S. Lewis's exact words, now the story of Christ is simply a true myth. A true myth. A myth working on us in the same way as others. That is, a big story helping us explain reality, helping us understand what is true, helping us deal with beauty and value and these sorts of things. A meta-narrative, or a worldview, you could even say. And the story of Christ is simply a true myth. A myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this tremendous difference, that it really happened. There's a video clip dramatizing what that conversation may have been like between Tolkien and Lewis. And we don't know for sure what they really said because nobody was there transcribing it, but this is a dramatic presentation of what that conversation could have been like.
But what is it that we're meant to be glimpsing?
Well, don't you see? The truth, Jack. Myths show us a fleeting glimpse of truth itself.
Truth. Truth. What on earth is this truth that you're talking about?
Quid est veritas. What is truth?
I'm glad to see that you've entered into the spirit of the myth, Jack. You've just cast yourself into the role of Pilate.
Pilate? Oh, I see. You're able to believe in the lesser myths because you've already accepted the big one. Once you accept the big myth, the lie of Christ, it's easy to accept the smaller ones. All right, Holmes, I'll play the role of Pilate. I'll wash my hands of the whole nonsense.
Well, Jack, you may be able to wash your hands, but your mind is still muddied. You're not thinking clearly at all, old chap. You're acting as if myths are mere arbitrary inventions of fiction. As if we pull them out of thin air. But what you don't understand is that we make things by the law in which we are made. We create because we are created. Creativity, imagination, is God's imageness in us. We tell stories because God is a storyteller. In fact, he is the storyteller. We tell our stories with words. He tells his story with history. The facts of history are his words, and providence is his storyline.
Are you suggesting that all of history, that everything around us, is all part of some divine myth?
We are all part of his story. This very conversation is part of his story.
But perhaps it isn't his story, perhaps it's only your story. How can you know that your story, the story that you believe, the Christian story, is any more real than the other story?
But don't you see, it isn't my story, it's his story. You're acting as if Christianity is one myth among many. It's not, it's the true myth. Christianity really happened. Jesus really existed, so did Pilate. And yet it is this true story that makes sense of all the other stories. It is the archetype. It is the story in which all the other stories have their source. And the story to which all the other stories point. It has everything. It has catastrophe and its opposite. What we might call eucatastrophe. It has the joy of the happy ending. The sudden joyous turn in the story that is essential to all myths. It has to a sublime degree this joy of deliverance. This evangelium. This fleeting glimpse of the real joy, to which all other joys are but a distant echo.
Tell us, what did you mean by catastrophe and new catastrophe?
Well, for example, it has the catastrophe of the fall, and the new catastrophe of the redemption. It has the catastrophe of the crucifixion and the eucatastrophe of the resurrection. It has everything man's heart desires, because it is being told by the one who is the fulfillment of desire itself. It is a story that begins and ends in joy.
But just because a story brings joy, it doesn't necessarily follow that it's true. There are many joyful myths. They all seem rather flimsy to me.
And yet this story has the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits.
Perhaps it's just a very well-written artifice.
This story has the supremely convincing tone. Primary art, not fiction, but of creation. And to reject this leads either to darkness or to wrath. And in my own life, it has led me from darkness to light.
Astonishing. Television astonishing.
I love the fact that Lewis calls Tolkien Tollers. Tolkien is phenomenal. Postmodernism, the cultural ethos in which we've been living for a couple decades, tells us that big stories, meta-narratives, don't exist, or they're not true, or they have no value. But I would actually say that this idea that the big stories are not of value hasn't gotten us anywhere. But depressed and adrift in a sea of preference and opinion, of people high on opioids trying to escape and morally lost. Rejecting big stories doesn't work. We need a story to live by. Stories, especially big stories, are too important to dismiss. Some of us here are not Christians. And I love the fact that we have people who come who aren't Christians but who are seeking. And I think a church that doesn't have people coming who are seeking, I think we're not doing our job. So some of us are exploring what Christianity is about and who Jesus is. But some of you here, I know, are reading the Bible. Or you're reading the Bible for the first time. Or you're reading the Bible regularly, even if it's a familiar thing. The Bible and Christianity is the true story of God's loving pursuit of fallen people in order to reconcile them to himself. That's a pretty important big story. God is pursuing us out of love. That is the big story. The loving pursuit is the core of Christianity. People get into debates and they argue over this and that. But they miss that core of Christianity that is God's loving pursuit. And when we come to accept that God is lovingly pursuing us, it reshapes how we read the Bible. The stories that we tell ourselves matter. The stories we tell ourselves about God's loving pursuit of us matter. And let me give you some examples. Think of some small stories and the effect that they might have on how you live your life as a person. If you live your life telling yourself that I'm loved, that's going to have a very different result than if you live your life telling yourself the story, I'm an accident. Two profoundly different stories that will have profoundly different effects on who you are as a person. Or imagine if the story you tell yourself all the time is, I'm a victim. How is that going to shape you? Or the story you tell yourself, I'm entitled. Or I'm right, or I'm abandoned, or I'm in control. These are all little stories that are actually fragments of a much bigger story that shape who we think of ourselves, shape what we think of ourselves as, and who we think we are, and how we live our lives. If you tell yourself constantly the story, I'm in control, and bad things happen, then you blame yourself. If you tell yourself all the time, I'm in control, and good things happen, you take credit. The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves matter greatly. And Christianity is the true big story that shapes our little stories by telling us at the very primary root level that we matter. Not only do we matter to other people, because relationships matter, but we actually matter to God himself. Enough that when we abandon him, he pursues us. It shapes how we face life. When we face difficulty, we need to remember that is not the end of the story. Think of the story of the man whose son was hurt, right? He was hurt while trying to train the horses, and he broke his leg and he was lame. That was a great difficulty. That was a tragedy. People would say, oh, why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? But in the end, the story turned out that his actually being lame turned out for good because then he wasn't conscripted into the army. So when we face suffering or affliction or difficulty, the big story that we believe and that we tell ourselves will shape how we understand the little story. I want to ask you, what are the difficulties you're facing today? I know a number of you are facing a variety of difficulties of different scale, different magnitude, different depth. As you face these difficulties, does it make you question the big part of God's story that God loves you? It's natural for that to happen, but I want to challenge that and remind you that the story isn't finished yet. Yesterday, a number of us were at the biggest funeral I've ever seen for a lady named Barbara Bulger. We've been praying for her. She's battling cancer. She lost her battle to cancer last Sunday afternoon. Her husband is a pastor at Lakeside Church. There were over 1,000 people at this funeral. And one of the resounding messages that came through at this funeral was that the story isn't over yet. That Barb Bulger is actually now with Jesus. This is the completion of her story, and it's a story of victory. Our part of the story is painful because we miss her, and we weren't designed to die. That wasn't God's intent for us. That's the result of our sin. And we miss her, and there's a hole left where she was, and there's tragedy in the fact that humans created in the image of God die. But the big story of her loving Christ radically changes our understanding of her battle with cancer, and the fact that in the end, she wasn't healed in her earthly life, but she actually has been healed now with God and will be given a body that will never suffer cancer again at the return of Christ. The big story shapes our understanding of our little story, especially in times of crisis and tragedy. Tolkien is famous for writing The Lord of the Rings, the epic masterpiece in which he creates an entire world. He's a sub-creator creating an entire world of reality. And in this middle book, the second book, as the two main characters, Frodo and Sam, are about to enter the dark land of Mordor, where the evil Sauron has all of his power concentrated, and they're exhausted, and they don't know if they can go on. And Sam, the faithful companion, he and Frodo have this wonderful conversation, wondering about what kind of story they're in. What kind of story are we in? And they recognize that actually their story, as big as it is for them, is actually one part of a much longer story, a much bigger story, stretching back to what they think of as history and the heroes of the old days, and that they're actually continuing on the same battle and the same storyline against the evil in their world. And Sam points out and says, all of the old heroes had lots of opportunities to turn back, but none of them did. Because the heroes who turn back are not heroes, and we don't hear about them. The ones that we hear of are the ones who did carry on, who did persevere, who did carry on in the face of evil or in the face of oppression or difficulty. And so they have strength to carry on. And Frodo wonders, he says, what kind of story are we in? What are the happy ending or a sad ending? Duncan Campbell, in the mud of No Man's Land in World War I, being trampled by horses, it's interesting that his thought in the back of that horse was, I'm going to die, but in the big story, I've done nothing to bring somebody else to Christ. I haven't shared God's love with anybody. And that is what mattered to him. His understanding of the big story of God's loving pursuit, he realized, I haven't done anything to help show somebody God's loving pursuit of him. And so he prayed, and people were saved. The big story of Christianity tells us that the story we are in has a happy ending. It is a story of victory. There's victory in the middle with the resurrection. There's victory at the end when we will be resurrected, when Christ returns and be given our own eternal immortal physical bodies. Our big story shapes our understanding of the little story. How we respond to the true story of God's love and pursuit of us, fallen people, will lead us to either darkness or wrath, in the words of Tolkien in that clip, or astounding light. Astounding light. For C.S. Lewis, he came to accept that the truth of the big story, even if at first it was reluctant. When he came to Christ, he said, I was the most dejected, reluctant convert in all of the kingdom of God. But it led him to be filled with light. And I want to ask you, how are you responding to the big story? The big, true story of God's love and pursuit of you. You are a fallen person. And God is lovingly pursuing you in order to reconcile you to himself. How are you responding to the truth of that story? Are you going to press on like heroes in the stories of old? Are you going to press on, or are you going to turn back and disappear and never be heard from again and drop out of the story? Stories are powerful. How are you going to respond to the true big story of God's loving pursuit of you to be reconciled to himself?